Adventures in EV ownership don't require quite as much adventure anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Lily Jamali. It is Friday, which means it's time for Marketplace Tech Bites Week in Review. We're joined this week by Joanna Stern, senior personal tech columnist at The Wall Street Journal. She'll take us along on a road trip through New Jersey's network of Tesla superchargers. The company is opening up its stations to other brands. Good news for Joanna, who has been leasing an electric Ford Mustang. Also this week, we'll get Joanna's take on what to expect at the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference, which, it was announced this week, will kick off on June 10th in Cupertino. But first, we look at a new law in Florida, the latest attempt to legislate away the potential harms of social media on children. It prohibits kids 13 and under from creating accounts on popular platforms. Here's Joanna.
Look, it's not for the lack of trying that tech companies have tried to get these kids off of their social media platforms, or at least tried to say, hey, we set an age of 13. If you're younger than that, you shouldn't be on here. But what happens is that parents end up signing up their kids. They make an account for them. And this is where we have a lot of kids that are younger than 13, frankly, on social media. And this is minors who are 14 and 15 this is targeting. So this is a step up.
Yeah, this is important. These platforms, as you just alluded to, whether you're talking about Facebook or Snapchat, they already have policies that prohibit kids under 13 from joining. Apparently, kids are using false birth dates. They're figuring out how to get around it, maybe with the help of parents. So do you think a law like this can actually change things?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Good luck to the parents, because they're going to be part of the enforcement here. I mean, also, this is going to be aimed also at the platforms for trying to enforce this as well. So, look, we've got a nationwide problem. This is one state trying to take it on, but we do have a nationwide problem with this. So where is the federal government? What are they doing here? And then also, what are these platforms going to be forced to do for all its users, not just the teens that live in Florida?
Right. Well, this law requires anonymous age verification. So this would be done by a third party. And your colleagues have been writing about this at The Wall Street Journal, saying, you know, there's a big question about how that actually happens. It is not entirely clear at this point. And your colleague spoke with David Wells over at Brookings, who told them, and I wanted to get your reaction to this quote before we move on, social media is like smoking. If you hook people early, you've got them for a long period of time. I'm curious what you think, because I am just now starting to break my own social media habits after 15 years of using it. And I didn't even have it when I was a teenager.
And this is the interesting thing. And I think, you know, an outright ban on social media for certain ages is one route to go. But as we're talking about, like, this could be really hard to enforce. And some of the other proposed legislation over the years has actually talked about those addictive parts of the apps and ways to limit those. And so you've had elected officials fighting for some of that. I mean, we've made no progress on this in the last 2 years, but where one of the ideas, and I forget specifically which bill it was or which piece of legislation, but it was specifically saying, let's take out algorithms for kids, right? That hooks people. Let's take out the likes and the favorites. Let's take that out for kids. What is a version of this that isn't as addictive look like? And kind of reverse engineer, if these kids want to be there and they want to be talking with their friends and communicating with their friends using these platforms, okay, well, how do we make it less addictive for them? And I think some of that legislation is interesting. We just have not seen it go anywhere.
No, we haven't. It keeps all of those bits of legislation end up in the courts ultimately. And you even heard members of the state legislature in Florida say, you know, this is likely to end up in the courts as well. The law is set to take effect on January 1st. So one to watch. Joanna, on to our next story. This week, I watched an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm in which a major theme was electric vehicle range anxiety. I thought of you and your Mustang EV.
I haven't seen it yet. I need to see that. You definitely need to see this episode.
Yeah, I think so. So you're allowed to charge your vehicle, your non-Tesla, at a Tesla station now, thanks to this new adapter. And we actually have a clip from some of your latest reporting on that.
I attempted to charge my 2023 Mach-E at 10 different Tesla supercharger locations in my fine home state.
It's a beautiful morning in New Jersey.
So what is the verdict on the new Tesla adapter?
Honestly, it's game changing. It's game changing if and I have been on the show talking about my EV adventures, but just to recap for those that don't sit at home always remembering my life history of buying cars or leasing cars, I decided not to go with a Tesla back in August. I decided after testing 5 different types of EVs that I was going to go with a Ford Mustang Mach-E. And my biggest downside to it was the charging infrastructure. I was so jealous of the Teslas and being able to go to superchargers, which there are far more of them in the country, and they are faster and they are sleeker, and it doesn't have a lot of the issues with payments, and they're not often as broken. And I've done a lot of reporting on how bad the public charging infrastructure is for ones that are not run by Tesla. And so now I have this adapter. I can take a charger at the Tesla supercharger station, put the adapter on there, and plug into my Mustang Mach-E, my Ford car. And so it's a game changer, and it works really well. And most of those locations worked. I went to those 10, and I mostly charge at home, as my story this week is about. Most EV owners do charge at home. It's more economical. It's more convenient. But if you're out and you're on a road trip, this is a game changer.
Yeah. And speaking of your work on charging at home, that reporting, you write, "I already discovered many EV virtues, but I didn't quite grasp the cost savings until I tallied up half a year of home charging data." And the figures are pretty remarkable.
Yeah. And look, this is what I tallied, that in the last 6 months, I've paid about $125 in electricity to charge the car. And now people are going to start to get into the math. Okay, well, how much did you drive? And so I drove under about 2,500 miles. And then people are going to ask, oh, well, what's the math of that would equate to a gas-powered vehicle? And that's where it gets difficult to break down because there isn't an exact equivalent. But I can tell you that I own another gas-powered vehicle. I have a family Volvo, and I can tell you I'm paying a lot more than $125 in 6 months to put the gas into that. And I talked through in this column that, of course, it's not just the savings, and I don't want to mislead anyone. There are a lot of things that are more expensive about getting an EV. The cars are more expensive themselves. I also had to invest in putting a special power outlet in my garage with a special charger, and that cost me about $1,500. But as I talk about in the story, there's a lot of subsidies and rebates that I was able to get with that. So
those coming from your state's electrical utility, right?
Exactly. Coming from both the state and the state electrical utility, which is PSE&G. Yeah.
So before we move on very quickly, did it help camouflaging yourself in Tesla garb to do this reporting on the mean streets of New Jersey?
It didn't. Because of the charge port location, these Tesla stations were designed for Teslas, which have a charge port in a specific location. And so my car doesn't have it there. And so, you know, no fights have broken out yet at the stations, but basically what happens
yet.
Is when but when I park, I end up taking two charging
right.
stalls. You know, I don't know, some angry Tesla person might come up to
me. I can see that boiling over into an argument at some point.
But honestly, I mean, you watch the full video, you'll see at the end, we have a very nice moment with a man who was in a Tesla, and he said, he was like, you know, wanted to make such a political statement.
Nothing should make us to feel like, no, you're a Tesla, you're in this and that. Same thing as a person. You're American, I'm not, or you're Muslim, you're Christian, you're black, you're white. No, nothing should be matter.
So it was everyone's been quite nice.
It was a very touching moment. And I got to say, I know you're a Jersey girl. The people of New Jersey came off very nicely in this video. It's a good group.
I don't know if it came off looking clean, but yeah.
We have links to those stories, by the way, on marketplacetech.org. That video is a must watch, everybody. We'll be right back. You're listening to Marketplace Tech. I'm Lily Jamali. We're back with Joanna Stern, senior personal tech columnist at the Wall Street Journal. We have a date now for Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference. It kicks off June 10th, goes through the 14th. Some interesting stuff. We're seeing some news about potential deals with China's Baidu, but also deals with OpenAI, Google, and Anthropic. I'm intrigued by this because of what it might say about Apple's approach to AI, thinking about how the approach might be play ball with everyone. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, it's certain. You know, we can never completely be certain about what Apple's going to do at this conference, but I think we can say very certainly here that they are going to be talking about AI a lot. The rest of the industry has been moving towards that, but that they have clearly been not there yet and not talked about AI or generative AI in their own products. So we absolutely expect that iOS, Mac, maybe Siri, we'll see what happens with Siri. Usually what Apple does is they announce these features in June and then they roll them out in September in the fall. Back to your question, I think what's really interesting about what they might be doing here is that Apple isn't a huge search company like Google, and they have in the past partnered with companies like Google and Microsoft to bring search to their devices. You can switch the default search engine in Safari. And I'm wondering if we're going to see a parallel here where we're going to see Apple say, we want to do some of our own AI things. And I think they'll do their own generative AI things with some photos and maybe with some translation and some of the things that typically we've seen from Samsung and others on the phone. But if you want to hit a bigger large language model, we can't provide that. That's not our business. So we're going to give you access to Google or OpenAI or Anthropic or Baidu, depending on where you live.
Yeah. We're also, it sounds like, possibly going to see the first update to the Vision Pro, which I know you loved. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what's to come there.
I don't know if I loved it, but yeah, I mean, we could have a whole other conversation about what I've done with the Vision Pro in the last
month. Wait, have things changed? I thought you were a big fan. Okay, forgive me.
No. Look, I think it's an intriguing device and the review is quite, you know, positive because you put this thing on and it is amazing. But then as I did a follow-up review a month later, it's sort of sitting in the attic. I'm not using it much.
Next to the BlackBerry.
Yeah, I'm taking it out to watch movies, but it's not something that's made its way into my everyday life.
That was Joanna Stern at the Wall Street Journal. You can find the full video of this episode of Marketplace Tech Bites Week in Review on our YouTube channel, Marketplace APM, and subscribe if you haven't already to watch us every Friday. Daniel Shin produced this episode. Jesus Alvarado and Rosie Hughes also produce our show. Lydia Ayano is our intern. Gary O'Keefe is our engineer. Daisy Palacios is our senior producer. Kelly Silvera is our executive producer. I'm Lily Jamali, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.